Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome back to Ranks FC for the third part of our World Cup preview. Today, we're looking through groups G, H, and I. My name is Jack Collins, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so. And joining me across the water is only Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
I'm good, mate. I thought I'd better pop on the old podcast that we run. You know?
Yeah, you know, occasionally, you know.
Quite important time of year.
Yeah, I hear there's a big tournament coming up or something.
Starts Thursday, I think. Yeah, Thursday is what they've got it penciled in for, yeah.
I'm sure, you know, in the US, it must be very difficult to get hold of these things, especially. You know,
it actually is, yeah. You wouldn't know there's a World Cup starting on Thursday in most places. I've literally, until like a week ago, there was no real marketing around it, at least where I am in California. So it's been a bit bizarre, but suddenly, yeah, like you've got stores like 7-Eleven stocked up on keychains and the little mascots. And Reese went in and bought a cuddly toy version of a World Cup, basically. So he's got one of those. We've got World Cup pin badges. They've got T-shirts. They've got the New England kit. Dylan's got Saka on the back. Reese has obviously got Reese James on the back. So yeah, we've managed to get into the zone, mate, but it would be very easy. If I asked my next door neighbour, do you know there's a World Cup starting in a few days, they would have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about.
Do you know what? It's funny hearing the different angles from different parts of the States as well. Obviously being on the radio and talking to different people, I think that certain places feel like they're getting there. Certain places like, oh, okay, it's World Cup week. We're kind of dialing in now. And then there's other places and you speak to people and they're like, no, still not really hit. And I'm kind of waiting for it to land. And yeah, it's a strange place to be.
Well, we've had a couple of friendlies here, obviously, in the last couple of days at Snapdragon. And the Colombia one in particular has sort of resonated because we've got that kind of South American vibe here in San Diego. And so, yeah, they had a bit of a party for that game, but yeah, generally you wouldn't know as much, but I think it will ramp up. Obviously there's a lot of Mexicans here. US is blows hot and cold, whether people care or not, but there are watch parties in most bars, Jack. And yeah, down at the beach in particular, there's a Mission Beach. There's a daily party with a massive screen right on the beach, which I do intend to go and check out. I'm going back to England next week. Pretty not the time to be going back to England, is it? Just as the world, this is football comes relevant in the US. I'm off back to England.
Circumstances dictate, mate.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the more important thing sometimes. But yeah, it will be fine. It will be fine. Everyone will get in the mood, particularly if the teams that matter to this region start to do well.
Yes. And look, the opening signs, I think on that front are pretty good. But we're not here to talk about the US and Canada and Mexico today. We're here to talk about groups G, H, and I. So let's get stuck into them. We'll start in part one here with group G, Belgium, Egypt, Iran, and New Zealand. And I think, Dean, you look at this, it looks to me like one of the weaker groups on paper in terms of where these four teams are at. We have a kind of nominal powerhouse in Belgium, who I wasn't that excited about, and I'm starting to get slightly more excited about as we get closer and closer towards this tournament. I think in Egypt and Iran, we have two sides who've, you know, met before and who are going to come into each other's vicinities again here and play out what looks like a pretty interesting battle for second spot. And then New Zealand, who are the lowest ranked team of the tournament, coming in that kind of fourth qualification spot with maybe a lack of expectation, a lack of pressure. We'll see what they're able to serve up to us. I'm a little bit worried about New Zealand, but let's start with Belgium. The golden generation is gone, but there is still quite a lot of talent here. Rudy Garcia in charge now after Domenico Tedesco departed. And what I like about Rudy Garcia, I'm not completely convinced by him as a manager, but he's pretty straight talking. And he comes out and he has these discussions and he's basically like, I'm not going to play an extra defender. I'm not playing three at the back. All of our talent is in our attacking players. And I'm not sure how his defenders feel about that. But he also came out and was like, I'd rather win 4-3 by playing an extra attacker than draw 0-0. And that's a fun, at the very least, way to approach this. I think Belgium might develop into a bit of a neutral's favourite this World Cup.
I hope so, mate. I mean, I hope so, because they have the talent in there to be an exciting watch. I mean, you say the golden generation's gone. It's not quite. And, you know, there's a few of them still
hanging
on. There's a few stragglers in Courtois and Lukaku and De Bruyne, and how much we end up seeing of those guys, obviously injury dependent, form dependent. But at least this should be the last time we ever mention the words golden generation in any way attached to this Belgium team, because it's been a lot. 20 years we've been talking about this golden generation.
I was a bit stunned to find that Axel Witsel was still knocking around. I've got to say, I was like, what do you mean? Like, surely not. But, you know, still going strong at 37. Respect.
37. Yeah, he's catching up with me. Look, these are all obviously very good players. And when you talk particularly about, like, Lukaku and De Bruyne, like 33, 34, same as Courtois. Like, it's not that old, particularly in international football, and you do need that degree of pedigree to remain. First impressions looking at the group, like this group stage shouldn't be a problem for this team. You would expect them to emerge from it. They should top the group, really. And then it's all about the knockout stage, about whether they have the resolve, I think, defensively to survive knockout football is something I will become interested in. On paper, they have a really nice team. On paper, they should be able to show a sense of attacking flair, like you say, particularly if let off the leash, that is exciting and a neutral's favourite. But I do fear that they play within themselves if they start to suffer setbacks. And if they start to play on the back foot at all, I don't believe that they have much resilience about them to hold out in those games that matter.
I think what's interesting is you kind of start to look at the position groups, right? And so goalkeeping still very much a strength. Courtois has had an injury hit season, but remains one of the best goalkeepers in world football. And he's now backed up by Senna Lammens, who's had a brilliant first campaign at Manchester United, was voted as transfer of the season in the Premier League, which, to be honest, I feel like probably should have gone to Granit Xhaka or Robin Roofs, but it is what it is. And then also Mike Penders, who might well be Chelsea's number one by the time that we start the next season. The defensive line is interesting because you think about that golden generation, and it's Vincent Kompany and Toby Alderweireld and Jan Vertonghen and Thomas Vermaelen. They had so many brilliant centre-backs, they couldn't fit them all in the squad, right? Or in that first team. And now you're looking at it and it's a young defensive core here. Arthur Thiat is kind of the elder statesman of this at 26 years old, who's had a pretty good career, I think, across Italy and then Germany now. You look at someone like Zeno De Bast, who still is only 22 years old and has been in and out for Sporting, but still a talented player. And Goy, who's been absolutely sensational at Lille, and I think is quite quietly one of these kind of fun players who might well emerge from this World Cup with their reputation enhanced. And Kony de Winter, who went to Milan, and obviously Milan have had a difficult season, but it does feel like he's someone as well that they can build around. So actually this defensive core in a 4 years time might be something we're looking at as a major, major strength. And we might look at this World Cup and say, wow, Belgium brought them all together early and they've kind of gone from strength to strength since. They're a little bit lighter in the fullback areas. Timothy Castagne probably going to start at right back over someone like a Thomas Meunier, who's 34 and another one of that straggler group, if you will, from before. And then on the other side, you know, it's likely, I think, to end up being someone like a Maxime de Kuyper. But that's a decent bunch of players, I think, to work with an eye on the future. And then you get into the midfield, and the fact that Onana and Tielemans are teammates at Aston Villa, I think will help Belgium in terms of how they're putting all this together, whether that means that KDB can roam around in front of them with less worry about having to kind of get back and do that defensive work. They've got someone like a Nico Raskin, who's been very, very good and pretty much Rangers' most consistent player, I think, for some time. There's a good group here. And then actually, if you get to the forward line, you're starting to think, okay, Doku, Charles de Ketelaere, Trossard, Lukaku, and potentially the wild card of the lot in Matias Fernandes Pardo, who I think is a lot of fun, brought to Lille from Ghent, I think it was, as a winger, has played pretty much up front this season under Bruno Genesio, and I think has had a really interesting season, starting to come into the middle, very quick with his feet, gets past players, gets shots off in dangerous areas. Another one whose reputation might well be enhanced if he gets the minutes at this World Cup. And that's why, you know, when you look at Belgium and you're starting to think underwhelming perhaps in terms of the players that are there compared to the players that were, but there's a lot of talent here. And I do wonder if maybe that lack of pressure post-Golden Generation might be slightly freeing for this Belgium side, who do have players who are sort of wild cards and game changers in quite a lot of different positions.
Yeah, it could be. And, you know, they have got a chance to build confidence here in the group's stages. But I think it's important to kind of reflect on qualifying as well. And like, there were some games when they were leaky at the back. You know, the team that came closest to them in qualifying was Wales, who ended up 2 points behind them. They played Wales twice, obviously. Belgium 4, Wales 3, and Wales 2, Belgium 4. And I'll tell you what, you don't want to get caught up too many times in a World Cup in sort of shootouts like that and basketball type matches where you're conceding that many goals. It is slightly alarming to me that against a team like Wales, they've conceded 5 times over those matches. So, that again comes back to that Achilles heel of the defence. And yes, there's a long-term strategy that fits and should be good for this team. But for me, there's a vulnerability there as well about them. I think in Rudy Garcia, like, it is a strong point of the team. I think that if he has to handle criticism, he'll be better prepared for it. I think he's likely to get less criticism if he does actually let this team off the leash and show some freedom than if he plays cagey for results. So I'm kind of torn there, because on one stage I'm saying, you know, I don't want to see games like 4-3s against Wales. But on the other hand,
I do. That's the thing. I don't think you can win the World Cup doing that, but I want to see it.
I want to say, from a neutral's point of view, I love those Wales results. From a Belgium fan perspective, I'm not sure it's a great sign.
No. And again, I think they'll be neutral's favourites rather than necessarily a kind of semi-finalist. But equally, if they get on a roll and they start to snowball, I don't think that you can look at that team and say, well, there's not enough talent to actually compete. And maybe that works in their favour in those latter stages. And they're like, right, we're just going to go for teams and see if they can deal with what we can bring to the party going forward. And if they go out like on their sword in that regard, perhaps that maybe is a victory within itself, with an eye on the next cycle as well. Let's go over to Iran, because you have personal interest in this one. Let's hear about it.
Yeah, so Iran have landed at the World Cup, Jack, and I was there in Tijuana on Saturday night / Sunday morning to see them touch down. Obviously, this team is caught up in a political storm, and I have a lot of sympathy for them, and I think this is going to be extremely difficult for them to contend with at the moment, as they fight with visa restrictions held against them in the USA. But yeah, I was sent by The Athletic over the border from San Diego into Tijuana at the weekend to see the team land. I mean, they were supposed to land at 1 a.m., which wasn't ideal, but not the end of the world. They actually ended up landing at about 5:10 in the morning, which was definitely less than ideal. So I had a sleepless night, literally waiting for this team to arrive at the World Cup. There were a couple of handfuls of Iran fans there waiting. I was chatting to them. It turns out, actually, in Tijuana, there is an Iranian segment of the of the region. And so they were telling me about it. They were like, oh, no, we have quite a lot of Iranians in our town, and we will be cheering this team on. And, you know, they also won't be going into the US to watch the games, as much of a standoff as much as anything. But they were kind of hopeful, they were resilient, and they hoped that this team can go and show something. Now, while we were waiting there at Tijuana Airport, they'd flown in, they'd done a training camp in Turkey in Antalya, and then they'd stopped over in Spain to refuel, which was where the delay came from, I think, from them reaching us in Mexico. But they've kind of started to get those preparations underway. We thought we were going to see the team walk out of the airport. As it was, they got off of their plane and straight onto a bus behind security gates, and then just drove past everybody very slowly. And they did stop there for a second, and we were kind of able to wave and identify some of the players through the window. A few of them like were asking if they could get off the bus to greet to see the fans that had waited there for them. You could see Taremi and stuff through the window, and some of the fans were screaming at them and stuff. But they didn't get off. Then they drove off to go and begin their preparations. I mean, to be fair, they'd just been on a plane for about 15 hours. I don't think too many of them would have wanted to chat at that point. And given the turbulent political storm around them, they definitely don't want to be doing too much media right now, particularly off the back of no sleep and no rest. So they've got to deal with that, mate. The fact that they have got this issue in the US as it stands right now of having to get in and out of the country within 24 hours is a joke. And I feel for them, like, particularly the game that's in Seattle that they've got. 24-hour visas are less than ideal. Some of their entourage don't have visas at all. It definitely puts them at a disadvantage in that respect. I think in the mindset that they'll have, maybe it's literally us against the world. You see these t-shirts of that regions have when they feel everything is against them, and I think Iran definitely feel it's them against the US/FIFA right now, and I'm rooting for them in that respect, mate. I hope that they can achieve something. I hope they get that first goal in their first game. I want to see them have a moment. I want them to, I don't know how they would celebrate, but I think that the fact that they are playing against New Zealand in LA as their first game gives them a chance of scoring a goal early on. And yeah, it's obviously going to be all about, not about football in the build-up to this game, but I hope that they can show that they are good at football.
Yeah, and look, they are good at football, right? They're coming into this World Cup with, as you say, a point to prove, an axe to grind. And sometimes there's little more dangerous than a team with a serious chip on their shoulder. And you actually look at their qualification campaign, they were very, very comfortable, right? They were the third team, I think, to qualify for this World Cup. They breezed through Asian qualification, which is no mean feat. There's some serious sides in there. And since then, they've kind of been experimenting. They're not afraid to try and change things up. We saw them try a sort of 3-5-1-1, it felt like, against Nigeria in March, and then go to a 4-4-2 against Costa Rica and really try to kind of hammer home their offensive superiority. They've got some players in here that, are able to cause a problem. Mehdi Taremi will lead this line. He's kind of the figurehead of this team. But I like Gayedi on the right-hand side. He's fun. And he should start to ease that burden. He's capable of so much in terms of moments of magic. He scored a brilliant, brilliant goal in that Costa Rica game to kind of announce his return after an injury layoff. And has finally started to find his feet a little bit later in his career. The worry I have is that their domestic league has been suspended since February. And how does that impact the majority of players who are playing their football on home soil? Are they going to be up to speed? Maybe it will help. Maybe that kind of rest and recuperation that a lot of teams won't have had comes to play in their favor. But I struggle to maybe see it in terms of just having that kind of up to speed games. We saw the dangers of the Iran counterattack in 2022, where they put together some really impressive performances. Can they be defensively solid enough to carry that off? I'm not sure. And perhaps the set pieces will come into play as well. It's a team of very, very big lads. They've naturalized Dennis Eckert, the standard Liège winger, which might give them something new, someone completely uncapped and raw. That's going to be interesting to see if that helps. But I do think that whilst they're tactically flexible, the fact that there is a lot of this team who haven't played very much football does start to worry me a little bit in the build-up.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an old squad as well. I know the coach has had to defend the fact that quite over 10 players were 30 or older.
I saw this. He was like, oh no, don't worry. The oldest players are the fittest players in our league. We're like, yeah, okay, sure. But like, really?
Yeah. And you're a World Cup now. You're not in that league. And that's that's a difference maker as well. But they've got a chance because of the new setup of the World Cup. They've got a chance of getting through it. I think the chance comes against New Zealand. I think they have to win that game if they're going to advance. But look, maybe, mate, everything that's gone on to this moment means that they treat that game like a final. You know, often that first game of a group stage can be a bit cagey. Teams don't want to go for it. You know, we don't know how this one's going to be, but tournaments can sometimes be slow to get going. And Iran can't be slow to get going. Like, this is huge for them to go to LA early in the tournament and produce a win over New Zealand that gives them a foothold on what they can do next. Because after that comes Belgium. Even though this isn't the best version of Belgium, I cannot see them beating Belgium. And then it means if they were to have got nothing out of those games, then the final game is that one in Seattle, which might pose difficulties in preparation and getting home and everything, all that sort of thing they got to deal with, to go and face an Egypt team, which might also be looking for a win to win the group or something at that phase, you know? So I do think a lot comes down to this opener.
Yeah, I mean, also there's a chance that Egypt-Iran game is basically a shootout for second place. You know, if Belgium go and win the kind of lot, as we expect that they might, then that means that there could be a lot riding on that game. And let's go to Egypt, right? Mo Salah's last chance on the World Cup stage. And whilst he hasn't had the best individual season, this is still a team built to accentuate his strengths. We saw that 9 goals in qualification. I think he was the second top scorer in the entirety of CAF. This is not a brilliant Egypt team, but it's a solid one and it has the capacity to hurt others. They're not going to dominate games, but when they transition, there is real quality. There's a solid core here, a veteran keeper, then Rami Rabia, centre-back, Atia in centre-midfield, I absolutely love in so many different ways. But you then come to who are the players that can hurt you? And we know that Salah's there. We know that Marmoush is there. Two players that can kind of make that difference on the biggest stages of all. But also Zizou, Trezeguet, players that we've seen do it for Egypt before. I think that for me, the key for Egypt is Emre Mashour, who is the kind of all-action midfielder who releases these hound dogs up front. He can push the ball forwards. He gets on it. He looks to go, you know, directly and quickly into those players that can cause problems. They've never won a game at a World Cup, Egypt, despite the fact that they were the first African nation to actually get to one. They were there in 1934 in Italy, but they've never actually ended up winning a World Cup game. So the kind of burden on their back is to end that, to win a World Cup game. If they do that, they beat someone like a New Zealand and they're in that conversation on the final day to potentially qualify against Iran. I think most people would have taken that in Egypt before a ball was kicked.
Yeah, they're going to win their first game at the World Cup. So that's for me, is going to be a thing to celebrate at this tournament. I don't believe that with the group that they're in facing both New Zealand and Iran, and with Marmoush and Salah as two of your attacking options, that you do not win one of those games. So if they don't, then this World Cup has definitely been a big failure for them, because this is a huge opportunity. I'm not sure I have major expectations for this team outside of the group stages, but I do think an opportunity to advance is there, and that even a result against Belgium is possible in a positive sense for them here if things go well. So quietly optimistic about the fact that they could become a team that is intriguing and interesting to watch, but more than anything, avoid defeat in the opener against Belgium. But even if they do lose against Belgium, they've got two fixtures in which they basically just got to win one and draw one and they'll be okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that takes us on quite nicely to New Zealand. I'm a little bit worried for New Zealand at this tournament, Dean. They look very, very light. They're the lowest ranked team at the tournament, beaten 4-0 by Haiti last weekend. They were better against England. It was very much sit in a low block and tried to defend. Obviously, the last time we saw them was 2010, where they went undefeated in that tournament. The only team, I think, to go undefeated in 2010 with 3 draws. Their coach, Darren Bazey, says they are miles better than they were back then. And I think that's probably true, if I'm honest. But I think that they come into this in a group where people are going to try and rack up scores, especially with the third place, you know, best eight, third place teams looking at it, I think that there are teams who are going to look at this game and think this is an opportunity. And qualification being an absolute breeze for New Zealand doesn't really give us too many markers. I think someone said in the Guardian preview of them that money for old rope, like they've won 14 of their last 15 games against teams in the region. They've conceded like 6 goals in that time and scored like 45. So you watch that and you're like, well, there's not loads I'm learning from this. There's a couple of really talented players here. We know all about Chris Wood, obviously. Whether he is fit and ready and able to lead the line is a big plus if that comes around. Obviously, he's missed a lot of this season. Elijah Just has been absolutely superb for Motherwell in Scotland. We like Libby Kikache a lot. And there is talent in this and some solidity. Joe Bell, Michael Boxall, Vin Sermon, Marco Staminic, all good, solid players who are capable of, you know, working it, of being in a defensive setup. Boxall in particular, who's been with Minnesota United for a long, long time, has been a standout defender in MLS for ages, really, at this point. But can this defense hold up to these other nations enough for them to stay in games and potentially create these opportunities? Right now, I'm not particularly sure.
No, I don't either. I mean, I think that the fact that there are a group that know each other extremely well and have got a team ethic and togetherness about them could count for something. The fact that they've held, you know, obviously England were not prime England and it was a typically dull England warm-up game. But from a New Zealand perspective, they'll take positives in the fact it was only 1-0. They're not going to try to be something that they're not and, you know, assert themselves on the team and go all out attack. I think they'll build up reasonably slowly. But they've got to optimize Chris Wood, right? Like that is their chance of getting out of this group. They've got a striker with proper European pedigree here who's done it at every level that he's been pushed into. And he can go and get him a World Cup goal that goes down in history. You know, we're talking about teams that have not achieved wins at this level, and New Zealand are another team that know they've got to get to that 4-point mark, and it's a big thing for them to go and do here. It might be that they come out with 2 points, you know, if they were to really push things, like are they going to get a win and a draw, or is it going to be 2 draws? Is it going to be 1 win? I don't know. I don't like the depth of the squad. You know, they've got like 10 players from the A-League here. Like that's not high quality in terms of coming into a World Cup. But it's not the toughest group at the World Cup, and that means that they have possibilities. Obviously, I talked about the opportunity for Iran in the first game to go and set a marker and give themselves 1 foot into the late stages. But obviously, New Zealand are going to see that from exactly the same standpoint and believe that the game on June 15 in LA is their opportunity to create history.
Yeah, I mean, look, and you talk about providing ammunition for Chris Wood. There is something that might work in that regard. Francis de Vries, who's the Auckland left back, has an absolutely phenomenal delivery, both from in play and from a dead ball. And if he can get that crossing on point, then we know how good Chris Wood is in the box and making those things happen. And look, if it's Jesse Randall, who's a bit of a wild card in front of him on that left-hand side, there is the potential there that those two can combine like they do at club level to be able to maybe put a couple of chances on a plate. If that happens, then there's hope for it. I'm just worried the other way that this defense is not going to be able to hold up in the same way that it perhaps does from a kind of continental viewpoint. And that might just be a little bit too much of a mountain to climb, but we will see. All right, we're going to put a pin in Group G there. We come back after the break. We're going to talk about Group H and many people's tournament favorites, Spain. Stick with us. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where we're going through 3 more groups in the third part of our 4 World Cup previews. Now onwards to Group H, Spain, Uruguay, Saudi Arabia, and newcomers Cap Verde. Dean, we'll start with Spain. They are the outright favourites at the moment with the bookies to go and win this tournament. And it feels like a relatively reasonable thing to assume, given Spain are reigning European champions, and this is an absurdly talented squad.
Yeah, I mean, they've got it all. And on paper, they deserve to be favourites because they've got they tick all the boxes that you would want to tick. They've gone and won a major trophy at the Euros. They've been consistent across Nations League and other games. They play attractive football. They play consistent football. And they have a squad that is packed with depth as well as game-changing, match-winning talent. And they've got a coach that seems to have brought it all together too in De La Fuente. So I think for Spain, like, yep, they're a creditable favourite to go and win the tournament. A lot is going to hinge on Lamine Yamal. And I do think that they need that, like, superstar quality. You think back to Spain as they broke through originally as like the great international team to watch and when they were dominating these scenes, and like it's the goal score element for me, Jack. Like, who will score the goals? I'm not saying like Lamine is like David Villa. I'm not saying that is a like for like comparison, but like you do need a David Villa type player to just have that reliability in the front line to provide. And look, Ayarzabal's one of the top rated contenders to win the Golden Boot. And that is because, like, if Spain are going to win this tournament, or certainly go far as you would expect them to get to the semi-finals at least, that they've scored a lot of goals and one person in particular scores them. So Ayarzabal's, like, there as the contender, the expected, like, central figure in the attack to go and do that. But if Lamine can get games together, then it'll be him. The thing that you've got in terms of, like, who emerges as the Golden Boot winner is the fact that they're playing Cap Verde, right? And they could win that game 7-0. And so if one of these players scores four goals in that game, then automatically they're kind of likely to win the Golden Boot. And that is something that you've got on that front coming into this tournament. Now, they've obviously got multiple other options. It might be that Ferran steps in as a worldie. It might be that Nico Williams, I don't know. But Lamine's obviously got doubts here against when we're going to see him coming into the tournament, and we need to take that into account. Their midfield capabilities are outstanding. Defensively, they've got a blend of everything I think you could want. I just like everything I see, really, mate. And beyond anything, there's not a fear in this team. You know, I look at the team I want to win it, obviously, in England, and I just know that somewhere for a lot of those players, there's a mental block. There's a fear factor that exists in their own minds. Spain love playing football, and they know they're good at winning, and they will expect to win the tournament. And that matters for a lot.
What I think is really interesting is that this team is just like universally beloved in Spain. And I know that obviously the fact that there isn't a Real Madrid player in here will have set a fire under certain publications, and there'll be some Real Madrid fans listening to this being like, yeah, it's nonsense that none of our players are there. And that's totally fair enough, right? Like, you can have those gripes. But actually, when you kind of look at this team, what they've achieved almost every time they've stepped out together, and the blend, as you say, of quality and talent is just, it's a little bit absurd. Like, people are looking at this goalkeeping core: David Raya, Joan Garcia, Unai Simon. We talked about Belgium's goalkeeping core. Like, all three of those would start for most nations. That's how good, you know, all three of them are at this point. There are a couple of questions, I think, defensively, but if it is Aymeric Laporte and Pau Cabarsi, as I think it probably might be, the experience and the youth and the talent, is there a better ball passing combination of those, of centre backs, anywhere on the planet than Laporte and Cabarsi? If you need a bit more defensive kind of heart in there, Marc Pubil has emerged as this incredible defensive presence. He might play at right back. He might play at right centre back. And if you get Marcus Llorente in there, he can play in a number of different positions as well. Cucurella probably likely to start a left back, but you know, Grimaldo in there gives you something different going forwards as well. I really like this mix of defenders from a Spain perspective. And then you get into those front lines. And as you say, I think Oyarzabal is one of the most underrated players on the planet, if I'm honest, at this point. He's got pretty much a 1-in-2 strike rate for Spain. So does Ferran, who gives you something a little bit different off the ball, gives you those kind of penetrating runs in behind. Oyarzabal is more of a kind of link player that brings others into play. And you know what? If they're desperate for a goal late on in a game, they can bring on the panda, Borja Iglesias, who is still doing it at 33 years old, and it gives you something different, someone to make it stick, someone to be that physical presence in the area. Kind of like a Joselu or a Fernando Llorente from years gone by. And the midfield balance is absurd, no matter how you spin it, right? Whether it's Rodri, who probably does kind of linchpin this as the captain of the side, whether it's then, you know, Pedri and Gavi in front of him, or Fabian Ruiz, who's just won back-to-back Champions Leagues, or Mikel Merino, who's been a key part of things for Arsenal, or Dani Olmo, who can play in the 10, Jeremy Pino can play wider in the 10, Baena can play wider in the 10. There's just so many different combinations and configurations of this team that all look brilliant. And I think that whilst there are potential weaknesses with Spain, and I do think that maybe with the amount of Barcelona in this team, are they going to automatically kind of drive up into a high line, especially if they were going to play something like Eric Garcia and Pau Cabasi together in the back line? Would they be tempted to kind of step forwards and step forwards and step forwards and potentially hurt in transition? Because, you know, we'll talk about France in a bit, but you don't want to leave them space in behind. But I just look at the quality. I look at the fact that it's going to be a hot World Cup and chasing the ball is a bad thing. And therefore, you're looking at a Spain side that love having possession. You're looking at a team who, if they win this group, get a route through to the final that goes SoFi, Dallas, SoFi, Dallas. Their games in the group stages, two of them in Atlanta and then one in Guadalajara. Like conditions-wise, all of those stadiums by Guadalajara are climate-controlled, right? So they're not going to have the same kind of blaring heat that some other teams are going to have to deal with until, if they get there, they get to a final in New Jersey. I just look at this team and I'm really struggling to find weaknesses. And I know that people will point to Spain and say, okay, what happened to the last World Cup where they had loads of talented players as well? And I get that. But I think that the upgrades from there and where they are now as a team, as a unit, and that feeling of cohesion in this squad is the reason I think that for many people, they're favourites.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think the fact that they have such a kind fixture to begin against Cape Verde is something that gives them that catalyst. And if they go into that game and are only win it 1 or 2-0, then I'd be surprised. It'd be a bit lackluster. I think this is an opportunity for them to kick on before they basically have an opportunity to slowly build up to the knockouts with that game, then Saudi, then Uruguay. Like that is literally like steps up the ladder towards the knockouts. And I think that they should utilize that.
Well, we'll see. We'll talk about Saudi Arabia and Cape Verde in a minute because I have a slightly differing view on where that is. But let's go to Uruguay first. And whilst Uruguay are a perennial powerhouse, obviously two-time World Cup winners, they are always at these tournaments, it feels like, and there's a lot of talent in this team, I am concerned, right? Because we are at the end of a Bielsa cycle. And when you get to the end of a Bielsa cycle, a couple of things happen. And one of them is that players effectively stop doing what he tells them, and it becomes as likely for it to entirely blow up in your face as it is to go well. Now, I think the fact that it's on a World Cup stage helps Uruguay here because they're not going to want to go into that and be like, well, we don't want to do this. We don't want to do it now because actually the eyes of the world are on you. And they're a very, very proud footballing nation. But I'm concerned that there's a lot of non-buy-in to this squad. I'm concerned that there are not many goals in this team. Darwin Nunez has the number 9 shirt, is going to be asked to lead the line, you'd imagine. Hasn't played competitive football at club level since he was bombed out of the squad in January at Al Hilal so they could bring in Karim Benzema. He's effectively just frozen out. We just talked about this with the Iranian League being postponed. I just feel like you're looking at a team here that is a little bit all over the place. Yes, there's decent quality in the middle of the park and in those centre-back areas. I don't know where the goals are coming from. And if this was a harder group, I genuinely think the Uruguay might have been dumped out. As it is, I think they will get through it. But I'm struggling to really see if I can buy into this Uruguay team as much as I perhaps did when Bielsa was first appointed.
Yeah, I mean, he's 70 years old now. And, you know, once people hit that number, people question how relevant they are to younger players, to the modern game. Obviously his mind is brighter and more understanding of the game than almost any of us watching it. But I do understand that that can become a problem. It became a problem with Roy Hodgson once he got to this point. And also, without battering him for being old, like it's hard. It's hard to like live life generally as you get older, particularly to be in the cut and thrust of a World Cup and games coming every few days and being criticized and being questioned and having to travel. Like it's an extremely difficult thing to do. Bielsa will believe that he's still equipped to do this job. Obviously, the problem he's got is that since Copa America, the team's form has been poor, and Bielsa has come under question and under fire for his role within that. I think he enjoys proving people wrong, so I'm not saying that it's impossible that that happens, but at the moment we're not seeing the best version of Uruguay, and a concern is how they're going to score enough goals at the World Cup, I think, to actually make the impact that typically you would expect them to make. Expectation will still exist because they are a traditional side that people expect to do relatively well, particularly at this stage and an expanded tournament. Uruguay should get out of the group. But I take your concerns, and I still believe that for Spain, like I say, they're building up. Uruguay will be one of the more difficult games. And part of the reason for that is that I think by that point, Spain would be expected to have 6 points in the bag. And Uruguay, it might be a game that they have to win. And that's why it could still be one of the more intriguing games once we get to that stage.
I think the thing with Bielsa, right, is that he's so incredibly set on his own ideas. And look, I love Marcelo Bielsa. Always have, always will. But also, it requires complete buy-in from your squad. And, you know, we're seeing Luis Suarez slamming him in the press and then apologizing and saying he was ready to play. And then that being a consideration, considering that Luis Suarez can basically not move anymore, gives me real jitters. Like the fact that he was even in consideration to return, I think speaks to this goal-scoring drought that's there within this side. And look, there are players here who can make things happen. Jorge Andrasqueta is a player I love and has kind of had a really, really good career in South America. And you're looking at someone like a Maxi Araujo who's had a wonderful, wonderful time of it at Sporting this season, who's been brilliant. But then, you know, Ronald Araujo is expected to be the kind of centre-back that's bringing the physicality, bringing that kind of energy and pace to this team. He's just gone back to Spain because he's picked up a calf injury and they're worried about his start of the tournament. Is Jose Jimenez still capable of being the leader of this team at his age, where he can, you know, he's not the kind of physical presence that he once was? If Araujo's not there alongside him, do they really kind of lack any impetus in that thrust? It all worries me a little bit. And yes, there are a couple of players here who've been called up. Agustin Canobio, I think, is a really interesting one. Can he do it at this level? I'm not sure. I don't know where all the answers are coming from right now. And whilst there is still quality, asking Fede Valverde to effectively just do the whole thing, and I know he's done it for Real Madrid for a lot of this season, you're looking at it and being like, can he do everything again? And look what that brought Real Madrid this season, which was ultimately nothing in terms of trophies. Is he going to be able to do that with a less star-studded class around him? I'm kind of struggling to see it.
Yeah, no, I think it's fair to question that, mate. Ultimately, it's going to come down to how they fare against these other two teams, isn't it? So they got Saudi and they got Cape Verde, and you'd imagine they win at least one of those games. But do they beat the Saudis, mate? I don't know.
Well, I think they do, because I think that Saudi Arabia might be the worst side in this group.
Do you? The worst?
Yeah, I think they might be the worst side in this group. And look, maybe this is me being romantic and talking about, you know, Cap Verde in a new way, but I'll speak about them in a second. This is not a good Saudi Arabian side. And I think that they might hugely underperform here in that they might come bottom of this group. Georgios Donis, new manager after Herve Renard and Roberto Mancini were both let go. Mancini first, and then Renard came in and it really didn't look particularly pretty. He had a bad start to kind of round three of Asian qualification. Then he started flirting with Ghana and then they were like, nah, not having that. And they've brought in Georgios Donis, who is a middling, if competent, manager in the Saudi league. And it feels to me a really underwhelming appointment. Again, lack of goals, a massive, massive problem with this side. Both Mancini and Herve Renard spoke about the fact that the imported forwards in the Saudi Pro League is stopping effectively young forwards coming through and making their mark at the top level. And it kind of plays out because there is a decent defensive unit here. There are some fun players in this squad. the Al Shamat twins, both have kind of had different impacts in terms of how this has gone. But when you're looking at it and thinking, okay, who do I like in this squad? I like Mohamed Kanu a lot. I think he's a really, really good player, was excellent in Qatar in 2022. I think that Alois is a more than capable goalkeeper at this level and almost certainly will be between the sticks again. And then you have someone like a Salem Oldarsari, who obviously scored the goal against Argentina that's gone down in Saudi folklore in terms of their footballing experiences. But he's now 34 years old, and while still capable of doing it, has not had the most productive of his seasons. I'm just really struggling to see how a manager of Donis's capabilities pulls this squad together and starts getting them scoring goals in a way that Renard and Mancini, both vastly more experienced managers at international level, simply couldn't, against teams who are better than what they've been playing. And actually, if you look at the Saudi record, I think it speaks for itself to a degree, because if you really look since kind of November last year, every time they've come up against a side who are better than them, they've lost, right? They lost to Algeria in November. They lost to Morocco in December. They lost to Jordan, who I think are a more capable and well-rounded side at this point. They got battered 4-0 by Egypt in March. They lost to Serbia. They lost to Ecuador a couple of days ago. Yes, they won 3-0 against Puerto Rico. But if that's what we're taking as a kind of gospel here, then I think that they've got problems. And we're yet to see them play against Senegal, but I would be stunned if they won that game. I'd be stunned if they came in on a high. I just think that this is a squad where the best talents who were there 4 years ago, who did look like attacking threats, have aged and are no longer at the peak of their powers. And they have a manager now who I do not see pulling together what is quite a disparate squad and getting the best out of them. I think they could be in for a big old shock here.
Well, I think, yeah, by bringing him in, they're relying on the fact that he knows the Saudi league. And as a result of that, he knows this group of players well enough that he can forge something in a starting 11 that is capable of competing with these teams on an international stage. Because, yeah, they don't have any players of European pedigree, really. You know, they've got one or two that have played there. But ultimately, like you say, they've stayed all within the Saudi league. And as a result of that, they've changed managers coming into the tournament. I got someone who just completely understands that culture and the level they've been playing at, and are hoping that because Donis has also been outside of Saudi, that he might know how to adapt them onto a different stage. It's a bit of a gamble, but to be honest, they might as well have taken it, because I don't think this team was going to do much without it.
No, I agree. Like, as in, I don't mind the gamble. I just don't buy it, if you know what I mean. Like, it's one of those things that I can't see them coming in. And I think that there will be pressure for them to finish third, right? Like, I think there will be an expectation that they beat newcomers Cap Verde. And to be honest, I look at this Cap Verde team and I very much enjoy the fact that they feel like they're coming in with no pressure and they're going to have fun. Dalian Livramento was quoted as being like, yeah, like the big one was getting to the World Cup. Now we're going to go out and just try and play our football and enjoy ourselves. And I think that that, compared to where the Saudi side feels like it is, might just be a bit of a winning formula. Look, they have an incredible array of players, Cap Verde, right? Representing 25 clubs in 14 different countries. In Bubista, the manager, they have a bona fide national legend in charge of the team. He's basically like, I set my teams out to be very organized, to sort it out, and I let them have fun on the pitch in their own way. I let the kind of Mavericks do what they want. And to me, it feels like the players are completely bought into this project, which is exactly what you want as an underdog. There's a physical defensive aspect in their centre-back partnership, in Pico, who plays in Ireland for Shamrock Rovers, and Costa, who plays for Villarreal, has been out all season, but is probably their biggest export. That's the big question around Cap Verde, whether he's going to be fit, Logan Costa. But Ryan Mendes has been around a long time. He's this team's heartbeat. Livramento up front is a lot of fun, right? Plays Casper in Portugal. I do really like him as a striker. I think after what he did in qualification, the heroics of all of that, he will be seen as the kind of talisman. Giovanni Cabral played for Sporting for a long time. Very, very talented player. A little bit mercurial in terms of how he operates. But I think that there's fun in this team. And I think that they'll go out there and be like, cool, we're going to try and play our football. I don't think they'll be that worried about the Spain game, but I think they'll see the other two and be like, right, maybe we can impose ourselves a little bit more on these two sides. There is no pressure on them. And I think that they come in here with like a quite a joyous atmosphere, a joyous surrounding, you know, this entire national team, that can be really dangerous in its own right as well, because they're playing without any expectation. I think they're a better side than Saudi Arabia right now. I think they might cause a couple of shocks.
Yeah, look, at the end of the day, mate, like this can be very open. Like if you take a risk, then I think that anything is possible here. And I think that that's the way that a couple of these teams really do have to view it.
Yeah, 100%. Look, I think Cap Verde, I'm not saying that they're going to do this, but I think of all the groups, they have an opportunity to maybe win a game here, which would be absolutely unbelievable. And I think if they are going to do that, I think it's probably Saudi Arabia.
So I mean, probably. Yeah. It's already a fairy tale, though, that they're even here.
100%.
So I think when your expectations are on the floor, then you know, it maybe helps you, you know. Some of these other teams are playing with pressure and they just haven't got it.
No, they're just going to enjoy this. And there's plenty of support for them as well, because there are immigrant communities of Cape Verdeans all over the world. Right, we're going to take a little break then. When we come back on the other side, we're going to go to Group I. And if you thought we were talking about favourites in Spain, just wait till you get a hold of France. Stick with us. Welcome back to Ranks FC and our third World Cup preview. We're getting into the groups now at the end of the alphabet. It's when you start getting to I and J and K and L, you know that tournaments are starting to get a bit more expanded. Let's go to Group I, Dean. France, Senegal, Norway and Iraq. Now, in previous editions, this would have been the group of death by an absolute country mile. But the fact is that a lot of these best third place qualifiers are going to go through. And you'd imagine that that might well be the case here. It's probably the group of death for Iraq. And we'll come on to them in a minute, because I actually quite like them as a side, but I think this is too big a mountain for them to have to climb. But we should probably start with France. And look, if you don't think Spain are favourites, you probably think it's this lot.
Yeah, I mean, look, the reason it's called the group of death is because in terms of, you know, every element that you look at to judge us, the squads and the groups and the teams, then this one comes out top. I saw a stat that said they had, across the average Opta power ratings of four teams, this group is the highest. So like in terms of the quality and the expectations, this one is genuinely right up there. France, obviously, are most people's second favourites. They are ranked as the second best national team. But we also know that they often can't maintain those expectations in one sense or another. Sometimes on the pitch, sometimes off the pitch. I think I've said that on every single World Cup and Euro preview that I've ever done. It remains. Obviously, like, this will be the final tournament for Didier Deschamps as the head coach. I don't know how I completely read that, if I'm honest. I haven't decided whether I think it's a good thing that he's still here for this one or not. But what we do know is that there is still the possibility of in-house problems here for France, and they're already leading into the tournament. There are storylines going on, and typically Mbappe is kind of central to this. Mbappe is going to define, you know, what the mood is in the camp, what the media headlines are of judging the team, and also what the goal power, what the star power is for this France team. And it shouldn't really be the case that it's not like it shouldn't be Mbappe or bust. And I don't think it totally is. But I do think it's the case that Mbappe defines how this team is read and like what the knock-on effect is to the multitude of talent that they have elsewhere. Like, to be honest, like, I'm preferring watching Elise than I am to watching Mbappe. But Elise's mood and form and temperament here is going to be affected by whatever else is going on. There's no way around that. But they're a brilliant team. I am excited by what we could potentially see. I think last time out in a tournament, they were a bit unconvincing. But because of Elise and Mbappe and Ousmane Dembele, oh, mate, there is the chance that he gets a dream send-off here. And if everything does come together, this could be extraordinary. Like, this could be brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, look, they have the capacity for brilliance. We often say, right, can France get out of their own way, right? Can France stop France beating France in so many different ways? And look, I think if you look at them from sort of November onwards, they hammered Ukraine, they hammered Azerbaijan, they then played Brazil and Colombia in the friendlies in March, and they went to the US to play both of them, which I thought was smart, get themselves acquainted with it a little bit more. Their performances against Colombia and Brazil, I thought, were absolutely sublime in some ways. They then lost to the Ivory Coast, and they're playing again tonight against Northern Ireland. You look at the team that played against Cote d'Ivoire and you kind of look at it and think, well, how many players are missing from that team? Pretty much the entire PSG contingent, plus William Saliba. There were reasons to believe that that's not the best variation of France that we're going to necessarily see. How they get all of this front line in, and I think it's interesting that Deschamps has been speaking about the fact that he was like, maybe in the Euros, we were a little bit too conservative. I think they scored one goal from open play, and that was Kolo Muani in the semi-finals. Apart from that, it had all been penalties or own goals that had gone into the back of the net for France. But I think Deschamps has been a weirdly unifying figure for the dressing room in a way that perhaps he hasn't been always for the French public. There has been this question mark over whether he's holding them back, right? Whether it's too defensive. But ultimately, if you look at, you know, the record, 2018, they won it. 2014, his first one, they got to the quarterfinal. They got knocked out by Germany, who went on to win the tournament. 2022, they lose on penalties in the final. Yes, they were a little bit disappointing at the Euros. But generally, under Deschamps, the kind of bottom line is, we're in it. And we're usually there right until the end. And I think that there is a sense with this France side under him that one last go round, he's not going to be the manager, you know, come August. Will they unite for Deschamps one last time? My hunch is yes, if I'm honest. My hunch is that actually they will find a way for this all to come together. And yes, there is this wild thing of being like, oh, do you play Mbappe or do you just play the PSG trio of Doué and Dembele and Barkala? But then you've got to bring Elise into that question. You've got to bring Ryan Shirky into that question. There are lots of different narratives going on, but the one that underpins them all is that this is an absurd array of talent that should, on paper, win this World Cup.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, if they can beat Spain eventually. But the first game's interesting, mate, because it's Senegal first up. And I mean, that's actually a tough game. And a potential banana skin. I wouldn't expect France to lose that, but they could, like, or at least couldn't fail to win it if they
don't. Memories of 2002, mate.
Exactly. But they are just so, so good. I mean, there's really not much to say about them from a footballing standpoint because there's very few flaws that you could address. And there's just like so many superlatives that you could just constantly throw out. And then away from what they're actually doing on the pitch, you've got Michael Olise's pitch checks where he puts 2 feet onto the pitch and then walks off it, which is going to be something throughout the World Cup. He's got the best pre-match routine I've seen so far of anyone, where just in his sliders, just checks the grass, wipes his feet basically on the pitch and then walks back off it, checking his phone. He does it all the time. And I think that now people are grabbing hold of that on a more global basis. That's going to be something that becomes quite funny. What isn't going to be funny for people is when Elise is running at them. This guy is bang on it right now, like bang on it. I mean, you've been crying out for him to get even more plaudits than he's got. And I think that this is the stage where he maybe gets it, mate. I think that there are people in the world who like football but don't love football and don't yet realise what he is, how good he is. And they will watch France to watch Mbappe, maybe to watch Dembele. But at least they could yet be the big star of it.
Yeah, no, I think that there is a relatively high chance that if France win this tournament, Elise might come out as the star man, because what he's put together this season has been absurd on a personal level for Bayern. And it's just about finding the combination, right, for France here. And sometimes that takes time, because you go back to 2022 and to pull a comparison with Argentina, the attacking line that started, you know, that first game against Saudi Arabia was not the attacking line that carried Argentina to the World Cup trophy, right? Occasionally, it takes a little bit of tinkering in the tournament itself for it to all come together. I think that whilst France do have that capacity for self-implosion, I think that there's going to be enough here with the quality that they have. And if one player drops out, one player isn't on form, let's just say that they go with, I don't know, Dembele, Mbappe, Olise behind a striker, and you're going, oh, maybe that's Marcus Thuram, whatever it looks like. If they do that and one of them doesn't play well, you're like, oh, no worries. We're bringing Désiré Doué, the current, you know, holder of the Copa trophy.
Oh, yeah.
Or we're bringing Bradley Barcola, who's had a very good season quietly, I think. Or, you know, you change it up. If, I don't know, Upamecano isn't playing well in that first game after he paired with Saliba, you're like, oh, don't worry, bring in Ibrahima Konate. Or we move someone like a Jules Koundé into centre-back and switch it up and play a Malo Gusto so we have a little bit more forward thinking on that right-hand side. Like, there are so many different options here. Manu Koné, I think, might come into this midfield if Rabiot doesn't nail down his spot early. N'Golo Kanté coming on to see out games. It's absurd what this squad looks like. And yeah. I'm really struggling with the idea that if things aren't working with this amount of talent in the background, that things that Deschamps won't change it up and utilize the squad he has at his disposal.
Yeah, and also, by the way, I've played down like what Mbappe is capable of. I'm trying to say like Mbappe might be a problem for France. He's also potentially the best goal scorer at this tournament, and his numbers have been outstanding, right, recently, and like that continues to be the case at international level. He's got like better than one in two, I think. Yes, he can be a bit moody. Yes, he can change the feeling around the camp, but that could yet be for the better. And that could easily happen. Like we've seen what he did in the last World Cup final. He's an outstanding individual footballer who, if he can also get in the team groove, is unstoppable. So I just need to stress that while I'm saying at the top there that Mbappe, you know, a lot will depend on him, and I'm just trying to playing that into a negative, it also could be that this guy takes you to the moon.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. I mean, look, you talked about him as potentially the best goal scorer in the tournament. He's going to come up against perhaps his biggest rival for that crown in the early parts of this. Let's go to Norway. A lot of people talking about them as dark horses. They have such an incredible forward line that people are very excited about. Their qualification campaign was such a success, getting back to the World Cup for the first time in a long, long time. 1998, the last time we saw Norway our World Cup, but wow, the amount of attacking options that they have and Erling Haaland leading the line makes them a very, very scary proposition for anyone coming up against them.
Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, I'm not really buying into the fact, I don't know how, when people are classing them as the underdogs, and I see this written everywhere, like they are like the dark horses, they are the team that are not fancied but are fancied. What are they actually fancied for? Like, they're not going to win the tournament. So what are people actually expecting of Norway that is beyond their capabilities? Because I expect them to get out of this group. Like, they're playing France, Senegal, and Iraq. Like, I do think that this squad gets out of that group. But I'll be honest, I don't think that they're a team that's going deep into this tournament. I watched the game they played at the weekend against Morocco. And Morocco are obviously a very good team. Half of that game, they were up against it. They came through in the end and managed to show what they are good at. But I don't know, mate. I don't. I'm very, very 50-50 as to what I'm expecting here. And it's, I fear it could be a little bit Belgium, if I'm honest. Like, they've got some great names. I don't know how you find the right blend. Oscar Bob did well at the weekend to set up a goal. And I'm like, how much will we see a player like that? How do they find the right combinations? I really don't know, mate. I honestly, I like the team. They lack tournament experience. They could be really exciting. They could be very vulnerable. I don't know.
I tell you what. I kind of look at it in a slightly different way, in that I like their tactical flexibility. I think that Solbakken is a very smart manager who knows exactly how to get the best out of this group. And we saw that in qualification. They can absolutely gun you down in terms of their attacking force. And the formation, I mean, it looks quite on paper a bit like a 4-3-3. it swings very heavily right in the way that it actually works out. A bit like Italy at the Euros in 2021. The effective, like Ryerson at right back, but on the opposite side, it was Spinazzola for Italy on that side. It's Ryerson for this Norway side. It kind of shifts into a 3-5-2. And you end up with Sørloth and Erling Haaland kind of prowling around in the box. Nusa holds the width as the winger on one side, on the left. And then Ryerson effectively bombs forward from right back. He's had an unbelievable season for Dortmund in terms of what he's contributed from an assist perspective. And then it allows you to effectively play Martin Ødegaard as a 10 to play those kind of penetrating passes through. And you kind of hold it down a little bit more in the middle with a Sander Berger and a Fredrik Arsenes. What that leaves you is Torbjørn Hegem, Christopher Ayer, and David Møller-Wolfer in a kind of back three. Now, I am unconvinced by David Møller-Wolfer. I don't think he's been particularly good this season for Wolves. He was not the Ait Nouri replacement that they needed. And in Ørjan Nyland in goal, I'm not particularly convinced there either. I think they will ship goals, but I think that they will score a heap as well. And the fact that they took that Morocco game, and it did feel like kind of first kind of battles between two teams that might well kind of overperform in some regards. Morocco were semi-finalists last time out. I have them pegged as probably being a better team now than they were then. Now, maybe the quality of the opposition has got higher as well, fine. But I think that Morocco are a more rounded unit. And the fact is that we saw a Norway side where Erling Haaland really kind of struggled to impose himself on the game, still come out with a very credible 1-1 draw.
Yeah.
I think that that's a good sign, not a bad one. I think that in Ayer and Hegem in particular, two lovely kind of ball-playing defenders who are capable of starting attacks, I am concerned that they will be a little bit easy to score against, but I think that they will outscore most teams. And that puts them in a position to potentially, I think a quarterfinal would be an overperformance. I think a semi-final would be incredible. I don't think we're going to see them go any further than that. But if they were to get into those kind of ranges, I think that would be seen as a massive, massive kind of dark horse run in the same way that Morocco were last time out.
Yeah, I don't know, mate. I just got my doubts because I think it's because so many people are tipping them. And I'm just like, they're a good team. But as I say, I think that there will be tests that they face in, they have to beat Iraq. Like they have to win that game. And then I just feel like Senegal beat them, to be honest. And I just think they're struggling and they're then in that third place race.
Yeah, I mean, look, if they're in that third place race, then they're going to have to score a bucket load against Iraq, and you wouldn't bet against them doing that either, right? Like that has the potential to happen. Let's talk about Senegal first, and then I'll talk to you a little bit about Iraq and why I actually think they're a better chance than, not a better chance, a better team than maybe people are giving them credit for. But Senegal come in as AFCON champions, at the very least in my eyes, and until CAS finalise up that decision, they will remain African champions for me. They've got a really good side. They have a lot of talent in this squad. They've got some star men still leading the line. Sadio Mane still kind of part of this, and his two goals against the States, I think, show that his nose for goal very much has not diminished in these years, even if he's slightly less kind of physically dominant than he was at one point. This is still a very well-balanced, well-put-together side. They've got a load of legs in midfield, in Pape Gueye, in Papi Mata Sarr, and Kamara. I feel like they're a really energetic unit that get up and down really well. They have game changers in different areas. And more than anything, they feel like they're all completely bought in, I think, to what's going on with this team under Papi Chao. And if you look at it, you know, in terms of who's stepping forward, Moussa Niakate, who, you know, was at Forest for a little while, is now at Lyon, has really kind of started to develop alongside Koulibaly as the kind of younger element of that centre-back partnership. Edouard Mondi is still a very, very good goalkeeper, you know, even a couple of years perhaps past what we thought was his peak. I just really enjoy the fact that this is a team who knows who they are, have a very good DNA, and have players who are able to make things happen on a sixpence. It's a really intriguing team, I think.
I just think that this team believes that they can go a long way, mate. And I think that while people keep talking about Norway, like, I just sense that within the Senegal ranks, they believe that they have the potential to go, not just to get out of this group automatically, but to actually have a run into the knockouts. And I think that that's a good place for them to be, that they have such lofty expectations and pretty good pedigree. When you go through the squad, mate, like they've got good pedigree players that play among the best clubs in the world. And yeah, I just think that, well, people are saying Norway, the dark horses. For me, Senegal are more dark horses, to be honest, to have a proper run at it. Because I think that, well, even if Norway were the ones that got out of this group automatically, I think they would go out quite quickly. Whereas Senegal, I could see actually not having that problem. So I have to wait and see. I think this is, for me, actually one of the more exciting groups, to be honest, in terms of not knowing. I know people talk about it as a group of death for strength reasons, but it's also just for unpredictability. And that's what I love about it, because yeah, Senegal are better. I'm sure of it.
I love their engine room. I've got to say, like, this midfield options, teams would kill for this. Pap Gay, who's had a brilliant season at Villarreal. And you're looking at Habib Diarra, who was a bit of a revelation when he came in at Sunderland, is just an excellent midfield player, kind of all round, and does so many different things. Pape Matar Sarr, still very young, but with a wealth of experience now at his disposal. Then Lamine Kamara, who is brilliant and I think could be on for a big, big move this summer. Idrissa Gueye, who's the kind of, you know, the experience in there as well. That is some phenomenal options. And, you know, we talk about the starting lineup. I think it probably is Mane, Nicholas Jackson, and then maybe like Ismaïla Sarr on the right-hand side. And then off the bench, you're bringing off Illiman Ndiaye, who is, you know, a phenomenal player to be able to bring on to run at players. Then Asana Diao, right, who made that move across to Como and is part of that incredible wide area squad at Como. All very, very young, all very raw, but absolutely encouraged on the Cesc Fabregas to just go at players and make things happen. Like, it is a really, really fun team. And I think it'll be a really fun team to watch. I'm with you in that I think that this could be a shootout between these two for second place. And I'm not 100% sure which way it goes. Mm-hmm. But I do think that when you're kind of coming up against it, I think both these teams probably will qualify in Norway and Senegal in some way or another. And then I think from that moment on, sky potentially the limit for both.
Yeah, so I'm just reading a quote from El Hadji Diouf, Senegal's third highest record scorer. He says, "We have nothing to fear from other nations. People have always before said that African countries would not get past the first round. But now the gap is getting a lot smaller and Senegal have every chance to go on and win it."
There you go.
Win it.
Sky's the limit, mate.
As he didn't even talk about the group. I think he's talking about the tournament. So there you go.
Well, I think that, fair enough. Come in. Well, I mean, the African champions, they've beaten a side in the final there that got to the semi-finals last time out in Morocco. No reason why not, I think, is probably where we're getting to. But this group is going to be a whole lot of fun for everyone, I think, apart from Iraq. And look, Graham Arnold, I think, has done a really good job with this team since taking over. They were a little bit meandering when he took the reins, and he's really kind of pulled it all together. If they were in Group H, for example, if they were the team in there with Spain, Uruguay, and Saudi Arabia instead of Cap Verde, I would have been talking about them in a very, very different way. But I think maybe it's still an outside chance with a puncher's chance. This feels like they're just coming up against the hardest group in the pack by a distance. They are tough, though. I've got to say, they are a tough team. They went through hell to get here in the qualifiers. That game against Bolivia, where they ended up qualifying for the World Cup, they didn't think they were going to be able to get there because of plane delays and obviously all the elements that are going on in the Middle East at the moment. They ended up on something like a 12-hour bus journey in order to get there. And then they go and win that game 2-1, win it out, and have some magical moments. There's some really fun players in this team as well. Amir Aoumari, key cog in the midfield at number 6. I think he's Swedish born, if I'm not mistaken, and has come through. I think he plays for Krakowia in Poland now, but has developed into a very metronomic, clever number 6 who helps to kind of shift the ball around and move it around the park and get this team going. How much of the ball they're going to have, I suppose, remains a slight concern. But Marco Fargi on the wing has just earned himself a move to Serie A with Venezia after a great year in Norway. And Ali Alhamadi has had an injury-disrupted year with Luton, but we've seen the talent when he was at Ipswich, helped get them promoted, became the first Iraqi player, I think, to play in the Premier League. There's talented players in this side, but I'm struggling to find a game where they get points. And for me, I think that's the difficult part of this. It's not that Iraq are a bad side. I just think they're coming up against overmatched opposition.
Yes, it seems to be the case. And like you say, even getting to this stage was a bit tough, you know. So to go here and succeed would be a huge surprise, particularly in a group as tough as this. They do have a blend of experience in the squad in terms of like where all the players play and stuff. Like they've certainly got adaptability for different types of fixtures and different personalities and players that are equipped to different challenges. But still, I don't think any of them are equipped to the challenge of getting out of this group. It's going to be astronomically hard. I think they'll produce a surprise result, but doing it more than once is going to be extremely difficult.
Yeah, there's quite a heavy Scandinavian influence on this team, which I think is interesting and something that might come into play perhaps against Norway. Yeah. But I do think that it does feel to me that there just isn't quite enough quality for them to come out the right side of arguably the hardest group in the entire World Cup. So it's no disrespect to Iraq to be saying that. I do think they're a decent side, but I think this is just a bridge too far, if you will. And I think, Dean, that will probably do us for today's preview. 12 more nations covered there, which takes us to 36 done and dusted in these previews.
Well
the
done,
final man. 12 will be coming a little bit later in the week as we build up to that opening day. As ever, thank you so much for listening to this Ranks FC World Cup preview. Thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate. Glad I could make one.
No, it's good to have you, mate. Maybe we'll make the next one.
I'll do the
well.
Next one too. There you go.
There we go. Two out of four ain't bad, as Meatloaf famously didn't say. I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. Thank you so much for listening as ever. And we'll see you all very, very shortly, Rank Squad. Take it easy. Peace.